He went to school for engineering and retired at RCA Global Communications. Yeah, a lot of these guys really were into radio. Like, I wasn't even thinking about a radio then. No, I was. Because I built a radio in wood shop. And, you know, the kind with just the wire around it. And you moved a bobby pin hair clip to different frequencies with a coat hanger antenna. But it worked. And I did hear stuff on it.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu.
Yes, Rich.
Find my handy talking, but here's a very esoteric one. What television show in the 60s had an ICO 720 as its transmitter when, of course, we know that was a low-band transmitter?
Was it Highway Patrol?
Nope, not Highway Patrol.
Personally, I have no clue. It was most likely a television show that I didn't particularly watch.
A policeman was in the show, but a major part of the show.
It wasn't Car 54.
Was it Mayberry? What was the name of that show with Ron Howard and...
You mean the Andy Griffin show? That was before Mayberry RFD.
Lou, you have my overwhelmingly kudos to you, because that's exactly what it was. Good old Andy Griffith had an ICO 720 on his desk in front of, I think, a D104 microphone.
Lou, you're good. Roy, you're good. I know you're good. Roy, next week I got three more. I've been finding them. I've been looking for things just to help myself, you know. From 59 and 60, I grew up. And a lot of them brought back old memories. So I'm having fun looking them up. So next week I'll bring you three more different trivia questions.
Okay, Sam. Very good. I look forward to them. And thank you, Lou. And thanks, Rich, for adding another question. I can see in my mind's eye that D-104 in Mayberry RFD, I never really, back in those days, I didn't think in terms of any model radio. The Andy Griffin Show really didn't elicit much kind of thought going on. It's nice and entertaining, simple stuff, but gave Ron Howard a beginning that he's still running with.
I had an ICO 720. That's why I know, that's why it was so apparent to me.
Oh, okay. Here's just a little bit of trivia to throw out, at least in my mind. For me, the only that I can think of portrayal of amateur radio operation in the early 60s television shows. So in other words, the question is, as far as I can recall, in the early 60s, there was a comedy where the one of the major themes of that week's episode was one of the main characters picks up amateur radio, and you see the guy sitting there and trying to talk on the radio.
Yeah, Roy, and the only other one I remember, I just called it out. You remember Car 54, you know, Car 54, where are you? And they were always on those mobile radios.
Well, yeah, those were mobile radios, but the thing that I'm trying to get at is this was a comedy episode where the main character said, I'm gonna take my amateur radio set out and use it. And part of that week's episode was the guy sitting there, and there are still stills of him dressed up as his character on the internet, trying to talk on a radio.
The Munsters, WS2N.
Yes, indeed, Paul. Give that man a star. It was Herman Munster, and there are still pictures of it on the internet. Just kind of Google Herman Munster radio, and you'll see him with a set of headphones on.
Comment.
Yes, Ed.
I'm in trouble. You recognize my voice. Gene Shepard purposely flunked out of radio school. He could easily do 30 words per minute. He flunked out so he could go to radar repair school. K2GJE, over.
Okay, I've read a book, a biography of him, and if you're a fan of Gene Shepard and you want to remain a complete fan of Gene Shepard, don't read a biography. He had a tempestuous life that was not all a nice guy. Ed, do you also know that when he was on the amateur radio bands, he usually did not go by the name Gene?
What did he use?
He used his middle name, Parker.
Anyone else would have done the same.
Okay, I think someone else was trying to add something, but it was 99% noise, so twiddle your antenna, raise up your gain a little bit, and try again. But Gene Shepard was a junior. His father was Gene Parker Sr. He was Gene Parker Jr. Apparently, his father was named after a character in a French novel that his aunt loved before his father was born, so they gave him the name Jean. He wasn't French, but it came out Gene. Anyway, the person who tried to add something, try again.
WB2EAZ, any better?
Much, much, much better, Ed.
In the movie A Christmas Story, which most of us know, was written by him and semi-autobiographical based on his writing, he uses the name Parker for the last name of the character.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did. And that was his biggest peak in fame. Unfortunately, he had left his gig at WOR. He had moved out of New York, gone to Hollywood, and was planning to become a major writer and creator of material. And he peaked with the Christmas Story, and then nothing much happened, unfortunately, thereafter. It's a shame. I have all of his books. He used to write short stories for Playboy magazine. I tried to collect his radio shows. I did not have enough money when I was a kid to buy that many cassettes, but later on people have been trading Gene Shepard episodes on the internet. If you do a Google search, there are some websites that have some random selection available, and if you're curious, try it out. It's very enjoyable. It's not dated at all, at least from my perspective. Okay, let's try again with Wayne. I tried to contact Wayne a little earlier, but he had apparently stepped away from the radio. So if you're back there, KD2UDU, if you have a question or a topic or a comment for tonight. Okay, I guess he stepped away. Before we get to the general science section, if anyone out there has any particular questions, amateur radio related, this is as good a time as any. If so, hit the push to talk and give me your first name and your call sign.
K2STP.
Yes, Chris.
Good evening, Roy. Just a quick question. I've often wondered this, and it just dawned on me I should ask you guys. I'm sure someone out there knows if you don't know. I've had a scanner antenna on my roof for a long time, 20, and I have a T in SO239T, so a three-way T connector, and I teed off to one location where I had I would plug the scanner in sometimes. It's a handheld scanner. And then the other side of the T went to downstairs to a different room where I could plug it in. And I've always wondered if that has a loss, number one, with nothing in either of the two sides, so with the extra cable and the T in line, what kind of loss does that create? And secondly, if I had something plugged in on both sides, does that create a loss because you're splitting the signal, I would imagine, into the two locations? Obviously, you can't transmit with both of them plugged in. But I'm just wondering what kind of loss that T would create.
WB2EAD.
Yes, Ed, please.
Yeah, let me put on the good antenna. Hang on one. All right, those BNC T connectors are meant for video and the like. They're not meant for RF. They give you terrible visual. Look, I'm on ham radio, terrible SWRs. They're only meant for video, not RF.
Okay, but it is, it's SO239T. It's not a BNC. K2STP?
Any T, they do not match impedances. I mean, what you're doing is it gives you a summation of the impedances on the other two junctions, and they add in very weird and funny ways. So do not count on them for anything. There's really no reason to use a T connector at RF as opposed to, like, you know, some form of a more elaborate power splitter or something.
Well, Ed, you know, if you're building some kind of a phasing strap, they come in very useful.
True, but I consider that below the scope of most of the discussions on this repeater and this net. If you want to go there, I'm all for it.
Well, you know me, Ed. I like to play devil's advocate, and when I understand what you're saying. Just for Chris's sake, splitters are kind of cheap solutions that engineers hate because there's no impedance matching. At best, if you have a splitter, you're going to have, best case scenario, if you're very lucky, a 3 decibel loss simply because it's the conservation of energy. But because it introduces, as Ed mentioned, all kinds of curious impedance mismatching reflections and otherwise, that optimum is nowhere near where you go. So although people use those splitters all the time because it's the cheapest, easiest way of handling it, you're far better to use a legitimate designed RF splitter that's designed to take a 50-ohm impedance signal and split it between two different connections, both of them now transformed to 50 ohms. But again, people use T connectors all the time, or I should say misuse them. But one of the very nice ways of using them, and something I've been reading up about, is phasing straps. If you have two antennas that are very similar and you want to leech both of them together to both transmit at the same time, one of the things you often use is a T-connector as part of the phase-matching cabling system.
If you're at that level, Roy, you're not asking these questions.
Okay, I'm just throwing in extra stuff. I mean, like I've pointed out before, one of the, I think, endearing qualities of the technical net is sometimes we roam the distances, but eventually we try and get back to where we started from. So that would be what I sort of just did, that T-connectors are misused all the time.
You want to know where a T-connector is perfect?
Yes, please.
Let us say you have some kind of a signal generator that you want to feed some kind of a signal, like a pulse, into a circuit you're testing. And you want to look at the input on an oscilloscope. Now, usually these things have BNC connectors. So you run a BNC to BNC cable to the oscilloscope, there's a T connector on the oscilloscope, and then run one to the circuit on the test. So the oscilloscope shows you the exact waveform going from the pulse generator into the circuit on the test. That is the perfect use of a T connector.
Okay, I agree. But you know, again, there are other uses and a lot of misuses. A lot of equipment tends to be misused, generally. So getting back to you, Chris, did we at least supply you with a degree of answer to your question?
Total sense. You know, I never really thought of it as a splitter. Of course it is, but for some reason I had in my head it wasn't a splitter. But, yeah, it really is just a splitter. I should have... Well, the reason I ask is I just did some recabling of some antennas, and while I was up there, I did I recabled my scanner antenna, which was 20 years old, and I ran it to those two locations. However, I did it with switches, so I bought the Alpha Delta two-position switches, and you know, I put one at the first location, and in the second. The B switch location at the first location goes back down to the second location, so it's not being, it's being switched. And immediately heard a huge difference in the receive on the scanner. So that's what I was trying to figure out, why it was such a big difference, and I didn't see it. So that answers the question, yeah, thank you.
Okay, very good. And as long as you brought up the concept of antenna switches, I always like to add on things like the TechNet that you always have to or should be aware of what frequency you're dealing with when you use a given antenna switch. Not all antenna switches are created equal. They have different isolation values for different frequencies. There are some that are rated solely as HF switches, and others that can switch at UHF levels. And if you take an HF switch and you try and use it for your UHF switching, because the amount of isolation is not great, you will usually notice that switching the knob has little to no effect on the signal strength, which is disconcerting at first.
Understood, because I did add those switches to all my other antennas, and some of those use the end connectors, so I had to get the different switch for them for that reason. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it, guys. K2STP.
Okay, you're welcome, Chris. Any other amateur radio-related questions tonight? Very well. We will enter the realm of science in general. And Wesley, N2XJN, has a comment or something to discuss. So, Wesley, what's your topic for tonight?
I sent you the email about FLIR or infrared, and I would like to discuss the topic from seeing through the walls, becoming sort of a spy, to invisibility. And I have material prepared for it.
Okay, infrared is an interesting topic, and I've mentioned this a few times on the technical net. A long time ago, about, I guess, 4 years ago, I had a conversation with Dick, K2RIW, may he rest in peace, about the power loss of the transmission lines and the fact that you should be able to put your hand on the cable and by assessing its ambient temperature, tell if it's wasting energy or not. And I tended to think that because of the very large surface area of a length of coaxial cable, unless it's really burning up, it's kind of difficult. And I suggested the idea of getting a infrared detector and taking pictures of transmission lines when I'm transmitting at full power, and I actually bought, there's an iPhone attachment from the same company that you just mentioned, FLIR. It's a very nice medium resolution infrared detector. Unfortunately, I was never able to accomplish the experiment because it basically requires someone to stand in the backyard in the middle of the winter, and I'm transmitting on my full power amplifier. And I was never able to arrange for that, so I still have the FLIR, so it's a little bit expensive for a toy to play with, but it's fascinating to use. I was able to find all kinds of thermal leaks in my house, some of which I repaired and some of which is kind of difficult to repair, but it is a fascinating subject. So with that little lead-in, tell us what you want to tell us, Wesley.
So we have a number of different applications, different topics. We're not only going to be talking about the infrared, but we can be talking about 2.4 GHz, which is the frequency that is used by a cellular phone that is being used also to see through the walls and see also inside the walls that you cannot penetrate or access. So at first we're starting from military technology. Swedish Department of Defense is heavily promoting that technology. It is being called adaptive. It is chameleon. So we know the chameleon can change the colors and blend with the environment. Now, how they did it? It's not really chameleon for your eye. It is chameleon during the nighttime for the night vision devices or for any kind of optical devices that would be trying to see large objects like a tank, so heavy armored vehicles or even airplanes or whatsoever. So we're talking about the armory. The system is being called Adaptive ADAPTIV, and it's unique camouflage system. So imagine that making a tank invisible with a cloaking device that is capable of masking the vehicle infrared signature to the enemy eyes. So it sounds like more like a scene from Harry Potter movie. It works this way. The vehicle essentially works like a little chameleon, able to mimic its surrounding or copy other objects such as trucks, cars, that can be projected onto the panels from detailed image bank. Also able to signal peaceful intent through flashing text messages across is bankable, or creating patterns that can be easily recognized by friendly forces. So let's say you have a heavy tank, but you want the tank to look like a pretty girl to the enemy eyes. that are being trying to spot the infrared signature of the tank. So on those hexagonal panels, approximately 10 inches by 10 inches, actually 10 inches hex, if you say 10 inches hex to 20 inches hex, those are like a pixel. And each pixel can have a temperature independently regulated. So it could blend to the environment by sensing what is the temperature of environment. The two ways.
Okay, Wesley. There was no real question there, but okay.
Now, if anybody has a question, that we ending when you're going to spy through the walls. So you have, everybody has a cell phone, and you could have a small device which has the infrared camera or infrared lens that could be put on that phone, and you could have something that is sort of X-ray vision. That would be one application that actually uses the infrared spectrum. But here we have something significantly different. We know that the frequency of the cell phone is 2.4 gigahertz, moving slowly to 5 gigahertz, and whatsoever higher and higher and higher. So now one of the guys was smart enough to patent the technology that it takes part of the power that is coming to the cell phone, but the cell phone, in order to communicate with the tower, cell tower, and so you are able to make a conversation, make a phone call, receive the phone calls, it has to act as a transmitter. So now we're talking about the cell phone being a transceiver. But now what they say is, okay, what is the signature of 2.4 gigahertz radar? Can we use part of that energy to simply transmit that energy in the given direction? So all we need is just an antenna. So we put something on the phone which is thin, has the implemented antennas in it, and now we could have a receiver and a transmitter antenna in that phone, or actually on the top of that phone. And if that energy is transmitted like a radar through the wall, and it is bouncing back, reflected by the studs, or anything else, or the person from the other side of the of that wall, let me drop. We could see that person. But instead of just giving you a pattern of something moving there, they decided they're going to put the sort of graphic. Like you can choose that the graphic that when you have a start is going to be sort of the cartoon, but very much naturally looking cartoon of the start. Or if you have a person, you could have it displayed not as an image, but actually as a person. You're not going to see the face, but you're going to see a cartoon image of some sort of the person and movement of that person. So this is an implementation of not infrared, but an radar that is using cellular technology. Dr. Ray.
Okay, Wesley. I mean, this has been done and demonstrated on YouTube before. People have gotten the idea that since Wi-Fi puts out 2.4 gigahertz and 5 gigahertz, they could kind of use different technologies to figure out the reflection coefficient and factor it into standard models of what it could possibly be and try to interpret images based on radar-like reflections.
That's correct. By the creator of the technology moved a little bit further. They created a 3D stats or 3D people, 3D object inside the walls or outside of the walls from the other side of the wall. And that is being called 3D imaging. That is created using radio frequency technology, the same technique that we use for Wi-Fi, mobile networks, radar system. And they use a technology called VIAR. VIAR is the technology able to use radio frequency to see through the solid objects and create a cartoon three-dimensional representation of that object. So if you're looking at the stud from the angle, you not only see the front of the stud, you not only see sort of the stud that you see from the angle, but you actually see the curvature of it. And that technology is represented by a video that I sent to you, but I'm going to say a few words about it. So, Wearabot is the technology that is being called the name. It's a handheld three-dimensional imaging device that plugs into Android, which is your phone. They don't have it with iPhone, or I didn't hear that they have it with iPhone, and allow you to see through the walls, objects, and materials. The parent technology, VIAR, was originally developed for breast cancer, and we're going to the medicine right now. Screening, providing something much more portable than mammogram machine and making it cheaper, easier, and safer for women to be scanned, but the makers believe that they are that there are many potential applications for it. And here we have two technologies which are actually medical, but actually applied to the regular life. Another device that is being used is some sort of patch. You're putting some sort of patch on your arm, and you are able to see infrared sclerotherapy device that could see veins behind that patch. So you could actually see them with your own eye. If we go to this area, traditionally ultrasound was something that was used for sclerotherapy. There was foam sclerotherapy, and there was a guided foam sclerotherapy that was the invasive procedure and the treatment for varicose veins. But then something changed, and we start to use detection of residual varicose veins with near-infrared light in the early period of and after varicose surgery and near-infrared light-assisted sclerotherapy. So actually that patch is sort of see-through material that is able to change the color depends on the temperature of that what is below the skin, so you could actually see the veins. Dr. Roy, maybe you can say more.
Well, I mean, not particularly. I mean, electromagnetic waves of different frequencies have different absorptions, and some things go right through, and other things reflect off the surface, and other things reflect a few layers down. As I mentioned before, I have an FLIR sensor. It's very amusing to point it at any old person that's passing by. You can actually see where their sinuses are, because they're cavities of warm air, but not as warm as the core temperature. So you see these little cutouts of slightly lower temperature, and the forehead is heating up as high as it can because the brain generates a lot of energy and dissipates it. And so a lot of different frequencies are very useful for different purposes of imaging different things. As technology improves, we pick up all kinds of nice emitters and detectors, and eventually we'll run all the way from 60 hertz to near X-rays and get all kinds of interesting three-dimensional imagery of the human body in medicine.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I thought I heard Wesley say that with this you could see somebody's veins. I wonder if that's true. If that's true, wouldn't that be good in a medical situation where they're always sticking needles into your arms? You know, and a lot of people that like me have a hard time finding the veins. You know, this way you could turn this thing on and they'd be able to see it right away. Back to you, Russ.
That's correct.
Yes, that would be a nice use for that type of technology. Of course, a lot of times you can see veins. It sort of depends upon what veins we're talking about. If you're talking about superficial veins, varicose veins especially, are incredibly obvious. If you take a color picture and you adjust the color tones, you can bring out the slight discoloration where veins are right below the surface of the skin. So superficial veins, not that big a problem visualizing. Deep veins are. Deep veins, lots of luck with that. You'll need some other technique, but not that difficult. The problems in medicine, though, are not only to find veins, but find patent veins. A lot of times in hospital environments, people who have already put intravenous lines into people repeatedly, some of the superficial veins tend to sclerose. Wesley was talking about sclerosing therapies. This is not meant to happen, but it simply irritates the veins. They sclerose, and now you got to go hunting for other veins. So the trick is to find nice, open, non-sclerosed veins that have good flow. Some people are great at it. Some people also, you have to figure out the depth, which is one of the problems. A lot of poor technicians who haven't learned quite the technique will overshoot and go right through the top and the bottom of the vein.
Okay, does this sclerose, when you get that, does it correct itself over time?
It depends upon the degree of damage of the veins. Very commonly under severe cases, those veins are shot. But as time goes, your body is capable of growing more branches and elongating smaller circulatory loops into veins. I remember, unfortunately, severe drug addicts had basically burnt out every superficial vein in their body. They simply had no source to inject heroin. And with those guys, I remember the joy on their face when you put in a central line into their vena cava, into the deeper veins. And when doctors and nurses weren't looking, their friends would inject their heroin into the central venous line. Those were happy campers for that moment.
Wow, okay. I was just talking about the superficial ones anyway, originally. You know, one way you would give blood, that type of thing.
Yeah, under those circumstances, you might traumatize the vein to a degree, but you won't probably sclerose it. So, you give it a little bit of time to heal, and it'll come back. But in hospital environments where very often people are having blood drawn multiple times each and every day, they burn out a bunch of the superficial veins, unfortunately.
Okay, thanks for that, Roy.
Okay. to the next chapter, night vision. So we know that night vision is being used by hunters and military and some other guys or some amateurs or people just who have curiosity. The old night vision devices are mostly based on residual light intensifiers, which are actually photomultipliers. So imagine that you have a typical tube, old-fashioned tube that has cathode and anode. And in between it has 10 to 60 or maybe 100 dianodes. So it's like an anode, but it's an anode before an anode. So if you look at the tube, you see that actually there are like 20 or 50 anodes. And one, the last one, is the major anode and has the highest potential. So some guys 50 years ago, they thought, hey, but if we make that cathode photosensitive, like a phototransistor, so we put photosensitive material on it, that will, based on the light coming to it, keep the potential on that cathode, and then it's going to go to be multiplied, and then take it out, multiplied. But in the meantime, people invented CRT. Now we have LCD screens in our TVs and our computer screens, but before that, we had a CRT. So it's like a tube. So now those guys, what they did is, instead of just in regular TV, the old-fashioned TV that you can only see, they decided to add additional things. Let's deliver the picture into it, not through the antenna, but through the optical sensor. And that's what they did. They made it, the first the tubes that could see. Those tubes in 40s were used for the first cameras, for the TV, and delivering those signal so it could send and transmit it to your TV somewhere else in America. And the other guy said, no, we don't want to transmit anything. We want to take this part of the tube, of the Vidicon, that was the name of the first tube, the Vidicon tube, that could see and sense the light, put it to the cathode, make one tube with number of anodes, and we, at the end of it, we want to present it. So the tube looks like that. You have a residual light going to the object length. It goes to the photosensitive material on the cathode of the tube, then it goes through the number of dianodes, which is the multiplying devices, and at the end of it we have a CRT screen, and you remember those screens from the old oscilloscopes, like it was like a greenish, and then we have ocular lens and we could see it. But then, many years later, somebody said, no, no, it's enough, enough, it's enough. We want to have something that is really, really good. And they put the technology that is in called black white onyx. What they find out is that it is much better if you have alternative black white night vision technology. And it's shown that at night, looking at such image is more natural, it's less fatiguing to your eye, less stressing to your eyes during a night observation, and you could have a pretty much a good quality of that picture. And somewhere 20 years ago, when they were building the technology, better. There were first military regulation, then government regulation for trading those cameras. You could not really buy those cameras, those tubes. So they have a different rates of it, and if we say that 50 years ago we had 20 to 35 lumens per millimeter amplification, now we have a 900 to 1200 times lumens per millimeter multiplication. So it's humongous amount of amplification. And that would actually giving us the operation. But at the same time, we have something that was started in 50s. And the company that actually triggered my investigation in this area is called Hughes. Hughes is a military contractor, and is being spelled H-U-G-H-E-S. They start to make a technology in 50s, 60s, and 70s that used cryogenic coolers for those tubes. What happens is when you have a temperature gradients, you have a lot of noise. So at first, when they were developing those tubes, they had to lower the temperature. So cooled infrared detectors must be coupled with cryogenic coolers to lower the detector temperature to cryogenic temperatures and reduce the heat-induced noise to the level lower than that of the signal emitted by the scene. And now we have uncooled one, and we don't care about it. But still, science and the medical field uses them. Dr. Roy, do you know about any sensors or any technologies right now using cold sensors?
WHCDL.
Yes, Andy.
Not to interrupt Roy, but I just want to add something that was asked a question earlier. When you get time, I don't want to interrupt. I said Roy, Wesley. Not to interrupt Wesley. I meant. So when you get a chance, give me a call.
And WS2N.
Okay, Andy recognized Paul. What's your comment?
Wesley's asking if there's any cooling devices on any kind of video detectors. Well, all your telescopes, your space telescopes especially, are using that. In fact, some of them actually have refrigeration systems to cool it down. The colder it is, the better it is. We know that for many years. So I guess that's what he's getting at. You know, all your infrared telescopes, including the James Webb Space Telescope that's going to be going up. But they're all charge couple devices. You know, it seems like you're talking about tubes, Wesley. But, you know, I mean, they're doing it today with CCDs. Back to you, Ron.
AC2GS. Well, yeah, I mean, cooling electrical systems to lower the ambient noise level for optical equipment is very common. If you have the money to run cryogenic devices, that's a good thing. Company is named after its original owner, good old Howard Hughes, who was probably the Elon Musk of the 1950s, if you will, in the 40s. He ended his days in a hotel room with fingernails that were about 3 inches long, and I think he was wearing tissue box shoes. So that does not bode well for Elon's future, but who knows? Maybe he'll be in Mars. But night vision is interesting. Maybe you could discuss the multiple generations of night vision gear. It's pretty much run by the military. They seem to be the driving force. There's one, two, and three generation night vision devices. There's theoretically generation four, but apparently that did not meet the military's criteria, and so it was never really taken out for that much of a spin. So I think for the most part, the best and the brightest are third generation night goggle technology.
Okay. Well, let me go a little bit technical. I was trying to avoid that. But I'm going to do it quickly, so I don't really bore the audience. Spectral region used in infrared tomography is generally from 0.9 micrometers to 16 micrometers, and more specifically, it's in the ranges from 2 micrometers to 5 micrometers and from 7 micrometers to 15 micrometers. And that is also being used by a number of technologies, which is NIR, SWR, MWIR, and whatsoever. I'm going to quickly go through it. So NIR is near infrared, SWIR is shortwave infrared, MWIR is medium wave infrared, and VLWIR is very long wave infrared. So that's actually either we are exactly on infrared frequency because it's a bandwidth, or we are below that or much above, heading towards visible light, because there is nothing above. It's just the infrared, and then it's visible light, and after that we have ultraviolet. And another thing, very quickly, thermal or infrared detection system utilize sensors to pick up radiation in the infrared part of the electromagnetic spectrum. An infrared camera detects the thermal energy and heat emitted to the scene being observed and converts it into an electronic signal. That signal is then processed to produce an image, and the heat captured by an infrared camera can be measured with the high degree of precision. This means that the infrared camera can be used for things like checking the thermal performance or determining the relative seriousness of the problems associated with the heat or the temperature of the body object or armory or whatever, so you could see the radiation that it emits. And then when we're talking about the infrared and we're talking about night vision, it's actually the same, because all of those devices are actually, what they're seeing is they're seeing the gradients of the temperature. So the difference between the temperature, and that's why some of the devices you can buy for $50, $60 and sometimes for $400 and $500, which is much better, those are either the addition to your cell phone or just the cameras by itself that could spot your heat problem in your house or in your apartment, so you could make better idea what your heat is coming from or going through. It also allows you to see inside the wall, but it allows you to see from in the spaces behind the walls. So whether that is a crawling space and you could see the structure of it, or you could see even the people in the next room. That's the how the technology is now. For that, there are special devices, sort of bolometers that are major components of it. So I'm just quickly going through it. A bolometer consists of absorptive element such as a thin layer of metal connected to the thermal reservoir, a body of constant temperature through the thermal link, and the result is that any radiation impinging on the absorptive element rises its temperature above that reservoir, the greater the absorbed power, the higher the temperature. So we have the intrinsic thermal time constant here that we're dealing with. And the last thing that I want to go, invisibility. The invisibility, by that I understand invisibility to the spectrum of light that is visible through human eye. But before that, anybody has a question to that what I was talking before?
Yes, Wesley, WS2N.
Go ahead.
These cameras that are looking through the walls, are these taking snapshot pictures, or are we talking about a video, you know, where you could actually walk along and see what's, you know, if you had, let's say, a couple hundred feet of wall, can you just walk along and see what's behind it, or do you have to take snapshot after snapshot after shot? Back to you.
With some cameras, 50-60 dots, you could do both the video and the snapshot, but the resolution is not that great. Something that starts from 300 dots up to 600 dots, and it's an addition to your cell phone, that could be good, but they have about 450 dots devices that are standalone, so you don't have to really use your phone for it. Now, with those devices, you can make a map. So actually, you're moving through the area, and you can make a map of your wall or whatsoever. And you could see inside. But the only difference is that that particle device that I was talking about, that is 3D, three-dimensional, is not really based on the infrared. It's based on cell phone technology. And the material is going to be on the Dr. Roy webpage, where showing the videos for each individual subject that I was discussing here. And to actually, there is one more thing. There is one video that I make a comparison between $25,000 camera and a $100 camera, and the guy is really honest. Based on my experience, he really gives you good advice. So you know what to buy and what to relate on. And to exchange.
That would be great for a contractor that was going to do a renovation job. You know, I mean, not the $25,000 cameras, but the $100 ones would be good. But yeah, that would be great. Okay, back to you.
The comment from the video on Dr. Roy website is saying that the camera for $25,000 has very narrow angle of view. So if he is, because he is working on it, so he is doing a job based on, not on renovation, he's not doing any renovation, he's actually doing scanning. So this is his job, this is his profession, and he shows every one of seven or eight different cameras that he has or imaging devices he has, and he says, well, this one for $300 is good for this, and the $25,000 camera cannot do it. So just watch the video, and it's worth your time. And to exchange.
I'll do that.
Dr. Roy, do you have any comment?
AC2GS, nothing in particular. I'd point out to Paul that, like I said, I have an FLIR attachment for my iPhone. It's a little bit expensive for a toy, but it is fascinating. You, especially when it's cold outside, you could run it across your walls and see exactly where the heat is just bleeding right away from your house. Sometimes it's very useful. Sometimes it's more annoying if you're not really prepared to do something about it. It's sort of the same thing of bringing a UV light to a hotel room that you're going to go have a sleep in, and you shine it around, and a lot of things that shouldn't be glowing are glowing.